The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Ranko and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone. Welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Ranko. Great to be with all of you today. This is episode 460, dated Friday, April 17th, 2026. And before we continue, let me introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, you're in Eugene, Oregon today.
We are in Eugene, Oregon, at a conference. And as I was telling you, Bob, it took me 2 hours to connect to the internet using hotel Wi-Fi. Everybody's blaming everybody else, but the good news is that I'm on. By the way, we had three supercomputer experts and me trying to figure this out, and it took us 2 hours. Anyway,
it took a long time, but you know, at least you got the job done. That's the main thing.
Good. And the weather here is gorgeous until Sunday when we're supposed to get more rain.
We're in 60s and 70s most of this week. It's been above normal, but it's going to get more seasonable as the weekend progresses. Before we continue, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer and editor. Thank you for what you do. Peter from Canada, thank you for posting our programs on my website. I'm sorry, on your chat board. Peter, you have a chat board that you post my shows on. It's Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions who posts our shows on my website. And I'll get to that in a minute after I acknowledge our media outlets. Thank you for airing us when you do. It is much appreciated. Jacqueline Sylvia posts our shows on my website, which is www.brankoevents.com. Go there, arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will find most of our archived programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I also want to say hi to a faithful listener who complimented us on one of our programs recently, Anthony Candela. Thank you very much for your support. We appreciate that. I hope you continue to enjoy the program. We also want to say hi to Cindy, who is our facilitator for today's program, along with Brad, who is our streamer. And because we are being streamed, let me give out my email address for those people who would like to submit comments about our program. It is bobbranco93@gmail.com. B-O-B-B-R-A-N-C-O. 93@gmail.com. We have with us today the executive director of the American Council of the Blind. He's been on our show before we decided to have him back. His name is Scott Thornhill. Scott, we welcome you back, and we're glad to have you with us today. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate you inviting me. Glad to be here. Last time I kind of co-hosted and had to try to fill Peter's shoes. So this was a...
Yes, that is correct. You certainly did. And you did a fine job, Scott.
Thank you, Bob.
You did a fine job. And I also, speaking of fine, I just want to compliment the American Council of the Blind. We need a great consumer advocacy organization of the blind. We have two great organizations, and I think it's important that consumers speak out about issues that they have to face on a daily basis. And you and the American Council of the Blind offer that vehicle for those consumers, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you.
Scott, I wanted to start with your football playing experience and sort of talk about the experience and what you learned from it and how that's impacted the way you lead at, say, the American Council of the Blind.
That's a great question tying those things in together. I'm a good sized guy, and I've been big, frankly, most of my life. I was too big to play Little League, Peter, but I, um, I was able to, you know, middle school, high school, and then into college, played. I was losing my vision. I have RP. And so I was losing vision a good part of that time. But, you know, anybody that's played organized, you know, team sports, that kind of thing, you can kind of get out of it a lot of times what you put into it or what you're willing to learn from it in certain ways or how you apply it to life. And some people do, some people don't. But I do look at it in terms of, I can talk some about some of the experiences around, playing football or some other sports. But in terms of the elements that I would have taken from it to take into my career in various ways, part of that is around, collaboration, of course, teamwork, would I be an obvious one, and doing your job, doing what you're responsible for and sort of staying in your lane, so to speak, in certain ways, but also understanding what else is going on around you, but not trying to, do more than what you're really tasked with doing. And if you carry out what you need to do the way you need to do it to the best of your ability, and everybody does that, then ultimately you tend to have success. And so I think that's one of the key things that I look at. And also just that approach of, I want those around me to be successful. And if they're successful, then most likely I'm going to be successful. And so that's also another related element of it for me, is that if I'm out for me, in terms of, especially in playing football, right? If I'm out for me and I don't care what those around me on my team, are doing, it's one thing to be responsible for what you're supposed to be responsible for. It's a different thing, to want the credit or want, to only have success where you shine by yourself. And so for me, I look at it as long as those around me are being successful and I can help them, encourage them, then most likely I'm going to be successful as well.
Where did you play football, Scott?
Well, I played middle school at the mighty, Carroll Middle School in Raleigh, North Carolina. Go Cougars. And then black and gold there. And then, played high school at Sanderson High School and also in Raleigh, North Carolina. Go Spartans, of the red, white, and blue. And then, went to Guilford College, a small, liberal arts school in Greensboro, North Carolina, to play college football, go Quakers, Quaker school. And now Quakers was the mascot. So, as I like to say, we could be assertive, but we couldn't be aggressive. That's a Quaker joke for my Quaker friends out there. But yeah, that's where I played. And that was the crimson and gray of, Guilford College. So, I played offensive line and defensive line, you know, middle school, high school. And then in college, I was, offensive line alone, played right guard in college.
So Scott, you mentioned sort of the importance of teamwork and the importance,
sure,
of knowing your spot and how it fits, mm-hmm, into the larger picture. And that's, of course, really important stuff that, yeah, you get in any standard leadership / team building workshop,
sure,
because I've run lots of them.
Sure.
But there's a piece that I'd be curious if you could talk a little more about, which is, mm-hmm, you were losing your vision while playing college football, especially. And, yeah, how did that sort of happen? And how did that impact the way you play football?
Yeah. And it really started, of course, you know, it was started from early on, but really at 15, when they told me that I would be blind by 40, which, as I've said before, you know, seemed really old when I was 15 and doesn't seem nearly as old now. I tried to overachieve. So I really hit that around 36, but you know, I've never driven legally. So I never had my driver's license. So during those teenage years, when you are in your teenage years and, you know, high school can be a tough time regardless. But, for me, you know, I was losing vision during that time. And boy, I tried to do all kinds. I tried to have prescription athletic, you know, glasses, and they would get steamed up and all of that. But, it was for me, I was trying to hide it, Peter. I didn't want anybody to know. I in hindsight, I had no reason to be ashamed. I had no reason to hide it, but I kind of, I guess, saw how society in many ways treated people with disabilities and that kind of thing. And I didn't want to be in that group. I also had a mistaken understanding of what the capabilities were for people who were blind. And, but it was a train that had left the station and I couldn't stop it. And so when I was playing football, you know, peripheral vision started to fade. And so while you know, had the size, had the, you know, some of the athletic ability in a lot in certain ways. I didn't have the, you know, all that I would have liked to have had and would have had different opportunities, I think, if I had. So ended up at Guilford College. And for me, you know, I had a secret that I was hiding that I didn't really know how to handle, just to be transparent. I really didn't know what to do. I would leave team meetings we would have on campus and I would take a different pathway back to the dorm, you know, than other players so that I, you know, wouldn't, if when I ran into a tree branch or stepped off the sidewalk or whatever that, you know, cause I had night blindness at that time and, you know, they wouldn't, they would have been relentless, giving me a hard time about just those kind of little things. And so, I made up reasons why I did certain things. You know, I lined up crooked out at practice. I snapped for extra points and field goals and punts. And one day I lined up sideways and the coach came out and he wondered if,
Hold on for a second, Scott.
Yeah. And so I went out and I was lined up for practice and I was lined up crooked to the goalpost on the practice field because there were no lines on the, on the practice field. And so I, you know, the coach came and he asked me, he said, Thornhill, are you drunk? You know, I said, no, sir, not today. You know, it just embarrassing things that, you know, you make up excuses for, frankly, in a lot of cases. I did at the time because I didn't want to deal with, you know, probably the reality of it. And then, so yeah, as you're, you know, as you're losing the vision and you find that it's getting harder and harder to, kind of keep up the facade, frankly, that I wasn't having any sort of vision issues. And I didn't want to tell the quarterback that one of his offensive linemen was, you know, losing peripheral vision. You know, a story that I've told before and you may have heard it, Peter or Bob, my first play in college as a freshman, my first play, I go out and I lined up offsides on offense. Okay. So anybody, you know, knows about football, you line up offsides on offense as the right guard. I'm right next to the center who has the ball. You know, you can't be much closer, you know, to the ball than being the center. So it was a 5-yard penalty against us. And then the next play they ran right behind me and we ended up scoring a touchdown. It was, you know, really a microcosm in a lot of ways. Of what can happen when you get a second chance, but I was hiding it and really didn't know how to navigate, and keep doing what I was doing. And so, you know, so, those two things were not compatible really.
So how long did you continue to play football while losing your vision?
Between high school and college, probably it was about a 3 or so year period of time, or 2 to 3 years, where it was really a noticeable thing. I ended up having a shoulder injury in college that kind of derailed me continuing to play, which frankly was a blessing in certain ways because I then moved to do broadcasting. So, I did color commentary, not play by play. So I had enough vision and enough where I could, I could do the broadcasting element. And understood the game very well and ended up doing broadcasting with another fella who also had played, you know, with me the year before, in college. And we both ended up, doing, you know, his was a different story. Mine was an injury, but, he did play by play and has ended up having a career in doing play by play for football, and basketball. So yeah, about a 3-year period of time where it was noticeable on my end.
And so how did this experience, the challenges you experienced and all that tie into your leadership skills, say at ACB? You know, this was sort of a unique experience that you had, not among blind people necessarily, but, among society as a whole. How does that influence the way you think about leadership?
Well, you know, some of the things that I mentioned earlier certainly, you know, pertain in that realm. I would say, you know, uniquely, if we look at it uniquely with the vision, element, you know, of this is that we all have a story to tell. We all have something that goes on in our lives. Even when we look at other people who we think have everything perfect, they just have everything going right in their lives. I can guarantee you they do not. The human experience tells us that we all have something that we're facing or dealing with. And, even if we don't realize it at the time, we all have certain things where we can improve, we can be better, or something that, might potentially be holding us back. And so sometimes as a leader, you're looking to, you don't know where you're going to meet someone. So one of the things, you know, I think about with ACB, and in my previous work was, meet people where they are. So meet people where they are, and help them get where they want to go is really something that I, subscribe to. And so you don't know where you're going to meet someone in their journey. I equate it to this. So for example, you could go to the doctor. And you could be weighed in at the doctor, which is, you know, not one of my favorite parts of a doctor visit.
No.
But you can get your weight taken at the doctor's office, right? And whatever number pops up. And it can be written down on your chart. And the doctor can look at that and they can go, oh my gosh, that's incredible. You've done so well from where you were. Or they could look at that and go, whoa, what are you doing? This is so much work. It's a snapshot of where you are in time. And unless you have the perspective of where you've been, it's hard to know where you are. And so when I think about meeting people where they are in terms of leadership and helping individuals in their careers or whatever it might be, you have to be willing to get to know people a little bit. In terms of their background, you have to be able to understand a little bit about them as individuals, not just as someone who fills a particular spot on an organizational chart. And once you can, you know, get to know people a little bit, then you understand a little bit better how to interact with them, how to help them become the best that they can be based on the full potential they want to achieve. And so for me, that's a big part of what this has done is I know where I was and what I was hiding. And, you know, people may have seen one thing in me, or thought one thing about me. When I was missing handshakes or tripping over a curb and didn't have a cane. And so therefore people could have had a perception of me, that wasn't accurate. I try to keep that in mind as I engage with other people that I don't know their history unless I talk to them and give them an opportunity to share. And then I have a chance at that time to help them become, if they want it, and I have the ability to, you know, if I have the ability to do it, to help them become what they want to become.
So one of the issues, that a lot of organizations are experiencing these days, including the American Council of the Blind, and I suspect any other advocacy organization, is the whole concept, a leadership concept of delegating, and which falls at the idea of you're the leader, who's going to follow you? And, you know, also delegating allows you to, not go insane by doing everything yourself. Talk about how delegating, has influenced the way you work and what suggestions would you give to folks who are having trouble delegating for whatever reason?
Yeah. You know, delegating, is a very, it's an integral part, but also a very challenging part. Of leading anything really, but leading an organization because we often, you know, and I come out of a background of my wife Jane and I having, you know, owned a couple of our own businesses and then, you know, got into the nonprofit world and the policy realm and now with ACB. You can get this mindset and it's very common, right? Of nobody's going to do it the way I do it. And as a small business owner, you can certainly have that because frankly, it's often true. You know, you've got, you know, blood, sweat and tears kind of thing in this business that you've built from the ground up or whatever it might be. And so you sort of have this idea that if I don't do it myself, or I might as well just do it myself because I'm going to have to fix it later anyway, I might as well just do it the first time and those kind of approaches. And ultimately they typically lead to burnout. And so I think there's a couple of different approaches to this, and it fits with what I just said a few minutes ago or a couple of minutes ago about meeting people where they are and understanding individuals and the strengths and weaknesses or strengths and opportunities, as people might like to say, that people bring into an organization. So if I take on everything myself because I believe I'm going to be the best at it and I'm the only one that's going to get it done the way, then what's the point of having the other individuals on the staff or on the team if I'm going to do it all myself? And it kind of cuts both ways, right? So if you have someone who you cannot count on to get things done, when you give the items to them and you teach them, and there's a method for that, right? They may watch you do it the first time, then they help you do it the second time, then you let them, you help them do it the next time, and then they do it by themselves while you watch the next time, and then you let them do it by themselves at the end. So there's going to be a process when you're training someone in doing something. But if you hire someone to do a particular role, Peter or Bob, I'd say if they're not going to do what you hired them to do, right, then you're basically going to be doing that work. So why have that person on the team, right? If there's going to be two of you and one of you is going to have to go because you're not going to pay two people to do the exact same thing. So that's one part of it is people have to take their, you know, their end of the bargain and say, okay, I've been delegated this. I'm going to take it and go. But as the leader, you have to be willing to let go of things and trust. I heard someone say, I heard a podcast where someone said that if there's something that I'm doing and someone else on my team can do it 80% as well as what I'm doing it, then I just need to let that go and understand that they're not going to do it exactly the way I do it. The result may not be exactly the same, but if they can do it 80% as well as I do it, then I should let go of it and let them do it. But you also have to, you know, be willing to step in and help people, and you can't just assume that they know what to do, because they may not.
And then there's the other sort of side of it, which is there are people who would like to accept challenges, but don't have confidence in themselves to do it, if that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
They'd like to do stuff, but they don't quite know how, or they don't feel they believe they can do it. And I'm sure you've experienced that. I know we all have as leaders.
Yeah.
How do you take on that particular challenge?
You know, I actually find that one a little bit more challenging because that one goes to the heart of how I want to be as a leader and how I always aim to carry myself as a leader, which is, as I mentioned earlier, to help those around me be successful and to achieve their goals. I don't enjoy being transactional in terms of leadership or in an organization because I frankly enjoy the experience less when I'm transactional. I enjoy the opportunity to help someone grow and become the best that they can be. And so when someone struggles with the confidence that they can do something or, hasn't been given that opportunity before. And so when you're given freedom and an opportunity to operate within space, I'm not one that likes to micromanage, and there's pros and cons to that. And since I don't like to micromanage, I do give people, I intend to give people a good amount of freedom to do what they're tasked with doing. And that also comes, though, the flip side of that is that you have to also be there when, like you said, they may not feel like they have the tools or they're ready to do what needs to be done. And that's the hardest part is when you're encouraging someone and you want to help them and you want to help them achieve and you pour into them and you believe in them. And yet they just don't quite believe in themselves as much as you believe in them. And I, admittedly, I struggle with that probably more than other things in leadership because you can only want something for someone else to a point.
And if
they don't pick it up and run with it, then, it's not going to ultimately be successful for them.
So Scott, in your opinion, in today's world, what would be some of the issues that you feel are affecting blind people today that, that are affecting them more than say they would affect them years ago? As we progress as a society, what are some of the most important things that you feel we need advocating for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, unfortunately, we're still advocating for a lot of the things, and we still need to for a lot of the things we've been advocating for a long time. They haven't gone away. You know, education, transportation, employment, elements of employment, those kinds of things. But I believe as technology changes, it's a very obvious, one of the obvious elements. And I don't know the most recent numbers, but it used to be that you would have a certain amount of growth in technology or in production, let's say in farming or, you know, manufacturing or whatever it might be. You'd have a certain amount of growth in 100 years, and then that number would go down to, let's say, 25 years or whatever those numbers may be over time. Now, if you read about these articles, listen to stories about it, the speed at which technology and information is growing, expanding. It's like every year, every 6 months, we're doubling almost the amount of information that's out there and what can be done. So do we have a seat at the table? We talk about this a lot around accessibility. So as, for example, these new tools are being created, whether it's new mobile apps or it's things, you know, AI right now is an obvious one that I would point out. As things are being created that are going to impact everyone's lives moving forward, do we have a seat at the table in those things? Are we participating in how, for example, some of the prompts and the various things are being set up with AI and our perceptions of people who are blind or people with disabilities, how are they being fed into these systems? Because, you know, they're only going to be as good as what's put into them. The information that comes out of them is only going to be as good as what's put into it. So I think that is in some ways, Bob, it's unique to the time that we're in. It certainly has happened in other periods, but it's unique right now because while at the same time, we've never had more technology to help us in a lot of ways. It's also a potentially pivotal time that if that technology, if we're not in line with having opportunity to be a part of the creation of those things, then we could find ourselves struggling to keep up as this technology continues to speed up.
And that's a real challenge.
It is.
There's another part to this, which is, you know, back in the 90s and the 80s, when I first got engaged with the American Council of the Blind, the culture was very different. Mm-hmm. We were more likely to get along, even though we didn't agree with, you know, certain political issues, for example. And now we're in a place where, you know, polarization is the big word, you know, where you're either on this team or that team and it's sort of hard. It's just a different world in that sense as well. How do you think organizations, advocacy organizations like the American Council of the Blind should adapt to that change, cultural change?
How the organizations should change based on the cultural change?
Yeah, in other words, yeah, I think things are different. I mean, what things should stay the same? How should we be thinking about advocating in given the current way we find ourselves?
Yeah, you really put your finger on something there. That is a challenge that I frankly in one way or another sort of it'd be overly dramatic to say that I face that on a daily basis, but it's on some level true. I will tell you, Peter, for me, as someone who, you know, I tend to, care deeply about, you know, a number of things for sure, like a lot of people. But what I've told myself and really the staff as well is at ACB is that you can only be sort of emotionally invested, so to speak. You can only be emotionally invested in so many things at one time. You also have to, on a certain level, and this could be easily misconstrued, so I want to be careful how I say it. You have to, on some level, be able to compartmentalize how things are said and how things are done and understand again. And it ties in a little bit with what I said earlier, meeting people where they are and understanding where their background may have brought them to where they are at this moment. And so for me, I may hear someone say something, or frankly, I may hear a post on a particular email list or whatever it might be, or social media somewhere. And I can immediately think something about that individual based on what they said, based on the words they've got in that post or in that email or whatever it might be. I can think a particular thing about them. And that's, not really a healthy approach, in my opinion, to go ahead and make that judgment about the individual. I much prefer, and that's why for me, this opportunities, and I got to tell you guys, like, we just had our DC Leadership Conference a couple weeks ago, and we'll have our convention at the end of July, of course. I get to go out to quite a few of the affiliates, ACB affiliates, and I really cherish that time with people. To spend time actually with individuals and not just sort of hear the screen, personas of individuals. And so what I sometimes find is that when I get that opportunity to speak with someone, while I may still not agree, they may not agree on, we may not agree on certain issues, that most people want the same things in life. They want to be able to live their lives. They want to be able to provide for their family, or they want to be able to, do the things that are important to them. You know, I've talked about education and employment and all those things earlier. I in the past several months have really understood as well that, like I've told people, we don't just want to work and go to the doctor. You know, that's as people who are blind or with low vision, we also would like to have some fun. We'd actually want to enjoy life. And so I
absolutely,
you start to get to the point where you realize we're all in this together. And while that message can fall on flat ear, you know, and I fall flat sometimes, I get that. There's no perfect answer to the question. I would just say that, you know, we're all in this together. And at some point, I cannot take on everyone's, sort of thoughts about the world. Like, I don't have the capacity to do that. I have to sort of let me boil it down here. I look at everybody and I put a 10 on their forehead. And it's something that a leader, John Maxwell, who I admire quite a bit and follow a lot of what he talks about in leadership. I put a 10 on everyone's forehead, meaning that I value everyone. I do my best to value everyone. That doesn't mean that everyone, you know, staff or affiliate or whoever, it doesn't mean that everybody is going to be a 10 in terms of what they bring to the organization per se. But as a human being, I want to put a 10 on everybody's forehead and value that person. And so if I approach it that way, I cannot take on, everyone's sort of, opinions about things and then create judgments about those people based on those things. I just need to care about those individuals and understand that we're on this earth together. It sounds cliche, but, you know, love people in a way that I think is genuine.
Before we turn it over to our participants, there's one issue that I want to briefly address that keeps coming up in a lot of conversations that I have with blind people. Sure. And I'm just wondering what ACB's stance on this is. And that's the issue of Uber versus guide dogs. I think you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's one that we continue to advocate on. And there's been some interesting sort of, I say movement, but some interesting dynamics that go on there. You know, the Uber has their self-identification, platform now for people who have guide dogs. I am not a guide dog, handler myself, so I do not have a guide dog, but several staff members do, and I do travel with them, and I've experienced, you know, those moments of anxiety when they're not sure if they're going to be denied a ride or not. I will say that since Uber, at least the information we're getting, since Uber has instituted this self-identification ahead of time, where a guide dog user can put in the system that they do in fact have a guide dog, and then the driver is notified that the number of, you know, cancellations of trips for that has been reduced substantially. And so people are having fewer denied rides, although they are still having denied rides. I don't want to put it out there that people aren't, because they are. But the percentages of them and the number, of them has decreased. Which is good. That's a good thing. Now, the flip side of that, or another side of that discussion, is that people would say, I shouldn't have to do that. And while, you know, I can agree that in an ideal world, you would not, you know, need to do that, and people should just always do the right thing and should never deny you with your guide dog. As I've heard a number of individuals who are blind say, they're like, look, you know, I can fight and advocate and do the things, but at some point I just want to get to the place I need to go. And so if that means that there's something put in place, what we're hearing now, whether it's from Uber or it's from Lyft or it's from those two primarily, is how they're going to handle the complaints and the scenarios now of drivers who are denying people with guide dogs. And so we continue to advocate. There's been some movement there. There's been some additional training, I think, because of the independent contractor piece. And here's the bottom line, Bob. I'm just going to put it out there, and I'm sure somebody won't be happy with me about it, and that's okay. What I also hear from a lot of folks who are blind is like, they can get mad about it, get upset about it. They can just be so, but guess what they're not doing is a majority of them are not stopping their use of rideshare. They are still taking Ubers and Lyfts because
they're not boycotting.
No, it was, I mean, so, and if, and a few may, which is not frankly going to impact, really, you know, Uber or Lyft. Those are the two I'm going to say primarily, because the reality is these were game changers in transportation for people who are blind or, you know, otherwise transportation challenged. They've been game changers. I mean, you've got paratransit out there leveraging Uber, you know, I mean, essentially themselves. I mean, it was such a game changer in transportation that despite these challenges, people are not stopping their use of rideshare.
And just to complicate matters, we talked about the rapid rapidity of change. Now we have these driverless cars, Waymo and other, the other folks are.
Yeah.
And that's being used in various cities.
It is.
And to various opinions of like or dislike, and the Uber folks are worried that they might lose some of their business over time.
Well, it's an interesting point, Peter. You've got a number of guide dog users who are very passionate in support of autonomous vehicles because, as the saying would go, no driver, no denial. So, you know,
let me go on record to say that I'm not too crazy about a driverless car. I don't want to be in a vehicle that nobody's going to control. I'm sorry.
So Bob, it's a great point. And believe me, I've heard the point. What I would say is, I have certain opinions about this. I will tell you, I attended the, what was called the Autonomy Summit 2025 back in December, in DC, and it was put on by the Autonomous Vehicle Industry Association. And you had a lot of different, transportation, you know, companies there and, rideshare and others. And this is very interesting to me. So for example, what you just said about a car that doesn't have a driver. So while there are people who will say, you know, oh man, that's, you know, scary, or I don't want to be in a car without a driver. They're one of the probably the biggest selling point of the autonomous vehicle industry is safety.
Yeah.
And it's around the fact that over 90%, really 95 to 97, it depends on the study, of accidents that occur with vehicles are due to driver issues. So what they would tell you is an autonomous vehicle doesn't drive drunk. An autonomous vehicle does not get distracted, is not texting while driving. An autonomous vehicle, you know, so that safety is one of their biggest selling points. So it's a
really, well, here's what a driverless car does though. Breaks down and nobody's going to fix it because there's nobody in the vehicle.
It can. I will say some of them, and not to get into too granular on this, but that is why some autonomous vehicle companies are having an easier time than others in getting deployment of their vehicles on the streets, is because some of them do have mechanisms by which, you know, let's say you have a scenario where you've got, an accident or something, right? Where law enforcement or first responders can, get in a vehicle or communicate with the company, and they can actually change so the vehicle can be operated by an individual. Obviously, if it breaks down due to some mechanical issue, then that may be a different thing. And I've talked with some colleagues about that and said, hey, you know, while you're not going to get denied by a driverless vehicle, right, with your guide dog, you also, when you get to your destination, for example, right? I often ask my Uber drivers or my, you know, rideshare drivers, I often will ask sort of, hey, so is the door directly to my right or whatever it might be? Now I can use another service. I can go to one of the, you know, visual interpreters or something like that. So there's other tools that you can use to do that, but a driver can also help in certain ways that obviously a driverless vehicle cannot. So there's pros and cons. It's going to be an interesting, it's going to be an interesting sort of journey here on what happens moving forward. But I will say, Peter, to your point, you know, in some places, and you probably already know this, but like, I think in Atlanta and maybe a couple others, you know, you can actually get your Waymo through the Uber app. So there's some sharing of technology there, I think, for various reasons, and able to get into markets a little bit quicker if you get in with an already established entity. So,
well, before we go to questions, Scott, you've been saying this in different ways, and it reminds me of something my mom said to me when I was growing up. I was born totally blind, and so she would say, "You can't fight every battle.
Yeah,
don't square yourself out. You got to choose your battles wisely." And focus your energy on those battles and be practical, you know. So, the whole issue of employment, which is my area of sort of, I focus on, when do you disclose during an interview? You know, people have philosophical opinions about this topic. And my basic response is I want to do what works that's most effective.
Yeah.
I don't care so much about the philosophical part of it. I want to do what works. So if it helps me to disclose, I'm going to disclose.
But
everybody has a different opinion on it, which is fine as it should be. But I think, I'd like more of us to be a little more practical in the decisions we made and the battles we choose to fight, because you said this better than I have.
Well, I do agree with you, and it is a hard thing, Peter. It really is for me, because, you know, we will come out with a position, you know, ACB will come out with a position, and that's not my, you know, decision alone to make, certainly what our position is, the board and, there's a role there, but I will say it's one of the harder things because, right, no matter what position you take as an organization, you're going to have someone in a membership organization, you're going to have someone or someones who are not happy with the position that you take. That's one thing I would say. So you cannot fight every battle, or you certainly can't fight them all with the same amount of urgency. You know, some are going to have to rise to the top in certain ways, but then that can cause people who have, you know, other issues that are important to them, if they're not prioritized, you know, sometimes to feel like it's not important. And that's not the case. It's just that you cannot put, I heard another person recently with a TED talk that talked about giving 100%. And they were talking about how leaders will often say, you know, well, we're going to give this everything we have. Every time we go out there, we're going to give it all we have. And her argument was, the reality is you cannot do that.
Yeah.
And remain viable for a long period of time, because you just can't give everything all you've got, or you end up empty. The practicality part, for me, I would say, whether it's the disclosure, and I know that was just one of the points you're making, is that, I think we have to frame things a little differently sometimes, and we have to look at the strengths that being blind, or with low vision brings to us. And as I've said to a lot of people, you know, you want to hire a problem solver, you know, hire a person with a disability. You know, a person with a disability who's been, you know, been working or living with that disability for some period of time, you're going to have a problem solver. because we find ways to get things done that people who aren't facing those disabilities don't have to deal with. And so, I think finding ways to change the conversation a bit, I like to put items on the table so I can take them off the table. So many people, I think, and I didn't do it early on. See, that's another thing I learned here is when I was trying to hide my visual impairment, hide those things, it's because I was afraid of what people would think of me. I was afraid of the results of what was going to happen. And what ended up happening was I got the worst of both worlds, right? People didn't know. I didn't tell them, and I wasn't doing things the way that I needed to. So they had a worse opinion of me than if I had told them. And so I now like to put issues, items on the table. And I think my sales background probably brought a lot of that about. Go ahead and get the obstacles on the table so you can get them off the table, right? If you don't bring them up, and so many employers and others are afraid to ask the questions because they're going to get their head bitten off or whatever. Let's have those conversations. Let's be real about it.
Absolutely. I'd like to turn the festivities over to our participants. You are listening to In Perspective, and our featured guest is Scott Thornhill, Executive Director of the American Council of the Blind. So what I'd like to do at this particular time is turn to Cindy and find out if anybody has their hand raised.
Actually, this is Brad. Cindy's got some audio issues, so I am looking for hands, and I'm not seeing any hands right now. I'll let you know.
Okay. Just let us know if that changes, and we'll be happy to talk to those people.
Brad, you are very good at that. I have faith. I'm delegating that task to you. Scott, one of the things that is a tension in the disability community, and I know mm-hmm. it's a tension in the American Council of the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind, is mm-hmm. the whole issue is what does it mean to be blind these days mm-hmm. and compared to, say, 30 years ago? And Bob sort of asked this question, but, you know, being blind back in when I got involved with ACB meant something quite different than I think what it means now. You know, back then, most folks who I ran into at conventions went to a school for the blind. I don't think that's as true anymore. most folks who went to an ACB convention, were blind. The sort of high partial piece wasn't as important as it seems to be now. Most people who went to the ACB convention were blind and either had no other disabilities or had at least unacknowledged other disabilities. That's mm-hmm. changed. And I'm sure there are other things that I'm forgetting. One of the things that I'll also say is when I went to my first ACB convention back in 1987, the idea of seeing an African-American person there didn't happen. It just, I didn't see an African-American person there. Mm-hmm. Most of the leadership there were men. Mm-hmm. The world has changed. And so ACB's role is to support blind people. But what does it mean to be blind these days, do you think? And how does that change the way we advocate for blind people?
It's a great question, and I wish I had just a beautiful answer for you, and I don't think I do. But what I would say is blindness, and this is something that I've, in my policy, role previously, and even in policy work now that we do, as many people may know, like blindness is one of, or has been in the past, one of the only, disabilities that really had a definition, a clear legal definition. That's where the term legally blind really came from in a lot of ways. So you were either blind or you weren't. So that's why I would say it's like, either legally blind. Well, if you're legally blind, it means you meet the definition in law of blindness. And so for me, I mean, that still is the case. I mean, that hasn't changed. That's a legal situation. But, for me, I just don't make a lot of distinctions in that for me, because so for example, you know, our low vision, members and those that we serve who may not even be members, but we serve them in one capacity or another through ACB's program areas. If someone does not meet that legal definition of blindness, I don't really care per se, if the services and the programs that we offer are meaningful to them because of where they find themselves in their journey with vision, then that does not frankly matter to me a whole lot, in terms of that definition. I think the multiple disabilities is an area that has become a lot more, challenging for sort of the, you know, the VR counselors, especially with some funding elements involved there, right? And the, sort of the order, you know, how services are provided and often the, those who can be placed the easiest into jobs, you know, so who ends up not getting maybe the services that are needed? And it can be those who have multiple disabilities. And so I think that's an area that we really have to look at. That is challenging. And I don't know that it's, you don't solve that. You don't really solve that. I think you try to manage and help and support, but I don't think it's solvable. It's kind of like work life balance. You don't solve that. You manage it. But I think that's an area that's become more prevalent and also because many more disabilities I think are being recognized today than had been. And so people have multiple disabilities. I think from the other social demographics that you were mentioning, whether it was, you know, sort of, men being primarily in leadership, I think at ACB, you know, I haven't been around that long with ACB, but certainly I have the history and I've been a member for several years is, you know, we now have I believe our, if I'm correct, our second, woman president. And you look at sort of the other social, you know, demographic elements of things where, different races and how that's done. I think that is a certainly, you know, positive development in how those things are looked at in leadership. But also in the leadership development, which is a key component, you know, of all of this. How do we do that? And that's why I'm excited about a lot of the things we have going on through our various, leadership development. But in terms of defining blindness or what it means to be blind, I guess I just don't get caught up too much in some of that. I look at what we provide as services, and if someone values what we do, as an organization, then I want to support that person and help them. I'm not going to ask for a doctor's report.
I guess what I'm sort of wrestling with is there is a broader range of lived experience among mm-hmm. blind folks than I think we were aware of back when I was got involved. You know, now you have, you know, blind people who are blind and fill.
Okay. Yeah, I hear you.
And that's sort of the challenge.
I hear you. And I think what I'm hearing, Peter, and I wasn't sure. I thought you might have been going there, but I wasn't 100% sure, which is sort of what people will hear about occasionally, in terms of, right. Is ACB, you know, somebody is more than just blind.
Right.
And you know, they have these other elements that make them, well, of course that's true. I mean, I hear these arguments sometimes that people will have about this, and it's like, guys, look, I think we would be foolish to say that, you know, I'm one dimensional or you're one dimensional, right? I'm just blind. Well, that's ridiculous. I'm not just blind. I'm blind. I'm a man. I got gray hair. Okay. My knees hurt. I don't know what else we want, but you know, I've got these elements about me. I'm certainly more than just being blind. Now that's one thing that I kind of put. Okay. I just say, well, absolutely. I mean, that's just reality. People are more than one thing. Put that to the side for just a moment and say, okay, then what does that mean for organizations? Right. What does that mean to ACB, of course, which is my primary concern and the thing that I'm concerned about the most. But I also can look at other organizations and I can say, well, what does that mean to, you know, sort of United Spinal, or what does that mean to the NAACP, or what does that mean to whoever it might be? Right. I don't know. And I don't know how other organizations view those things in terms of, okay, you were created for this particular sort of area of focus and to support people who come together because of this thing that they have in common to an extent. And so that in my opinion, should remain the primary thing that we are focused on, because that's why we were created as an organization, was around that particular issue. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignore that people bring other things to the table, or that we, certainly not that we, you know, ostracize, or that we, don't let them be a part of the organization because, you know, in addition to being blind, they have this other factor. That would not be acceptable to me or to anyone else, I hope, that we wouldn't do that. But then you get down to that next question, which is, okay, so we sort of accept those things that we're all more than just one thing. We don't want to exclude people because of, you know, other things, because then we'd all be excluded one way or another. So then how do we bring those things together? And I think that's what we're wrestling with, Peter, is, you know, how much of that do we not just acknowledge, because acknowledging is a pretty, I want to use the phrase duh, but that's going to get me in trouble with someone, but we obviously have more to us than just being blind. I don't know that we can effectively, we've already talked about the challenges with just advocating on the blindness element. So I frankly don't know how effective we would be bringing in other demographic or societal elements in addition to blindness, and now saying we want to try to really go after and effectively advocate on those combined elements. I don't know that.
Well, but see, it seems to me that, the one of the ways you deal with this is that you have certain, issues that we have to address. Employment, you know, you mentioned a lot of them, yeah. Right? Technology, so on and so forth. Well, then you have people with lived experiences who are going to see this issue through a different prism.
Sure.
Right? They're going to experience it differently. They're blind, but sure, because of their other things, they experience it differently. So how do you incorporate those lived experiences into the advocacy work that you're doing?
Yeah.
And one of the ways you do that, it seems to me, is you share stories. So
yeah,
you don't just give the stories from one person's perspective. You talk about, right, you know, a person who maybe is a rural, it lives in a rural part of the world, who had, you know, and are struggling with issues that may be very different from the urban person, for example. You know, you can cut this in any different number of ways. The whole issue of meeting people is different depending on the culture you live in. So how do you, so we want to focus on blindness.
Yeah.
We also, and this is a tension, you can't solve.
And we have about 2 minutes, gentlemen.
But you get the idea.
And so real quick, what I would say to that, and we can do one final thing if you need to. What I would say to that is that's one of the strengths that I feel like sometimes we miss, as an organization. It's a strength that we have that I think sometimes we overlook or we don't realize or think about. So for example, we have over 60 affiliates. Many of them are geographic, meaning our state affiliates, and then others are special interest affiliates. And so people bring some of those elements you're talking about based on where their affiliate, you know, elements of their affiliate. And so when we leverage advocacy opportunities, so for example, like DC Leadership Conference or, currently our, you know, the Speak Four platform where people can reach out, they can personalize that outreach. I think that's a huge strength for us, is for people to personalize those in such a way that does give, you know, elected officials, either in states or federal, wherever it might be, those that are controlling some of these policies, does allow them to hear the personalized stories of individuals who are part of a blindness organization, but bring to the table a very unique background. And I think that's where we have a strength that we don't necessarily leverage.
And that, I think that's,
and with that, we need to wrap it up. But, you know, Scott, I think that the ACB has a positive direction. I feel it. I've felt it for a long, long time. And I know that you'll do your best to continue steering the organization properly. And I hope for good things always from the ACB, particularly with advocacy and anything else related to that. And we want to thank you for taking the time to join us today on In Perspective. And continued success.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate it.
Come back sometime soon, Scott.
It's a pleasure.
We'd love to have you back, Scott. Really, we would.
I appreciate it.
We'll get sometime in 6 months.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Appreciate being here.
Thanks, everyone. And go safe with God's abundant blessings. And we'll talk soon. Have a great week.
This is Bird Note. The American tree sparrow is a common winter visitor in the northern U.S., but there's more to this little brown bird than meets the eye. Despite their name, American tree sparrows stay close to the ground. They'll even nest directly on the ground in open shrublands of Alaska and northern Canada. In their summer home, the sparrows raise their young on protein-packed bugs and juicy insects. In winter, American tree sparrows rely on seeds from grasses, wildflowers, and bird feeders, especially millet. When foraging, they'll kick through leaf litter with their powerful feet and beat seed heads open with their wings. You'll often find them foraging in mixed flocks with other species. Keep an eye out for a little brown sparrow with a dark spot on its cream-colored chest and a two-toned bill that's black on top and yellow underneath. Though American tree sparrows are common in North America, their populations have steeply declined since the 1970s. You can welcome these birds to your neighborhood by growing native plants, keeping cats indoors, and filling bird feeders with a millet-rich seed mix. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is dedicated in memory of Pat and Joanne Adams of Hartville, Ohio, who enjoyed caring for backyard birds and shared that joy with others.